Hey everyone, this is Luke. Welcome to Exploring Kodawari. A quick intro here. I started this podcast during the COVID-19 pandemic when there was disturbingly too much free time and it felt right to avoid, you know, succumbing to the darker stuff and instead make a podcast about deeper positive stuff and how we make meaning in life, exploring cool topics, interviewing cool people, etc. And I kind of imagined that with a podcast up and running, once life returned to normal and our musician schedules returned to normal, it would be easy to keep publishing episodes. That has turned out to be more difficult than I thought, since this is going to be our only episode of 2025. But when I thought about it more, it does make sense. Kodawari as a concept is all about being uncompromising in the quality of what you put out. Not necessarily like the result part of that quality, but the quality of attention and care, let's say intention, that you put into it. So I guess in hindsight, it does make sense that every time I sat down to write notes and potentially do a podcast, I realized I didn't devote enough time or depth to the topic that I wanted to talk about. But I can say that we at least haven't missed a year. At least I arbitrarily decided that putting out one podcast episode a year keeps a podcast on life support. So last year, in a panic, we recorded a quick podcast on New Year's Eve and published it just in time for 2024. However, this year, my usual co-host and wife is traveling. So I decided to take the quiet time at home. I have 4 full free days before a Christmas gig and then some traveling. So I collected some stories, reflections, thoughts, and other things that have been occupying my mind across 2025. Most of this comes from the Notes app on my phone. I have various note files and, you know, like with categories, note categories on my phone with names like Music Trumpet Thoughts or Luke Stories, Luke Thoughts. And then there's my favorite dumpster file for any random thought I have called Luke's Spiritual Brain Droppings. I also have a favorite quotes note. So maybe I'll end the episode with reading some of my favorite quotes that I added in 2025. Anyway, I don't know how this episode's going to be. It's kind of just going to be a stream of consciousness style episode going through some of the things I've been thinking about this past year and hopefully not ranting too much, but I hope to be able to publish it so I can at least say I did a podcast in 2025. Hope you enjoy. Okay, so I think the first reflection I'll start with from 2025 are things I wrote down musically, like after a performance or while traveling for this gig or that, just sort of musical ideas and reflections I had this year. So the first one is about flow. And if you're a musician, you know what we mean by this word flow. But even in non-musical music muggle circles, flow is something that you can feel when you have it. It's hard to describe. People study it psychologically. But I had heard this podcast about flow, and they were talking about, I guess it's maybe the guy, the psychologist who coined the term, I'm not sure, but he wrote a book called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. I can link the TED Talk this person gave, and I haven't read the book. I only heard a podcast about it, but I wrote down this quote from it. I think I was on a plane somewhere, and it said, flow is found at the intersection of discipline and surrender. And I love that idea of, you know, you can't flow in a concert if you haven't had the discipline to practice and really ground the music into your DNA, so to speak. But you also can't make great music or find flow if you just try to copy the exact disciplined way that you already played it. You have to surrender to something in the moment. You know, being in the zone feeling where you can feel your brain processing faster than you can even think. You have no self-consciousness. It's when what you have to do is just beyond what you're capable of, or certainly what you feel like you're capable of. So you have to have these skills disciplined and ready to go, and then sort of surrender. To me, that means take a leap of faith and sort of play on the edge of things so that new things can happen. And then later on in this podcast, they added to this concept of flow to talk specifically about groove in music. It said, quote, groove is found at the crossroads of discipline, surrender, and mischief. And I loved how Like, it's not just surrender. Like, adding this word mischief in just really, like, lit up my brain when I first heard it. It implies a sort of, I'll talk more about a book that we've been quoting from a lot. Me and my wife have been quoting from a lot. But this mischief concept is kind of similar to duende, which is kind of like, what is duende? Well, my wife, Yanka, found the concept in a book called The Demon and the Angel, Searching for the Source of Artistic Inspiration. And it talks about a lot of artists and a lot of concepts, and more on this book later, because it comes up in another topic I want to talk about. There's a really trippy story around it. But this book talks about duende, which is a mysterious, almost demonic force. It was talking about flamenco, but it said this applies to pretty much any art. So this mysterious, almost demonic force that descends upon an artist, and coincidentally, by the way, my wife is in Spain right now, so that's kind of funny. So this duende, kind of like the word mischief, reminded me of duende. And there's a quote that I wrote down from this book as well, which was, "All truly profound art requires its creator to abandon himself to certain powers which he invokes, but cannot altogether control." So it almost has this same kind of feeling of you're disciplined, you practice, you invoke certain powers, but by doing so, it's like, I am not in control of all of this. I have to have this element of surrender, or if not surrender, maybe it should be something more like seeking. There should be a seeking element in how you play, a sense of curiosity so that you might discover something new as you perform. In the past, I've always called this, you know, taking the risk to be on the border with the unknown, or on the border of order and chaos, or that could be like discipline and surrender, just being on the edge of things. So I love that quote, and I love the concept of duende. And in groove, you can almost imagine like playing something in a live concert where you purposely throw a little mischievous wink into the mix to wake people up and make them really make music in the moment, and not just be like repeating exactly what they practiced and basically be a musical zombie about it. Yeah, so that's the best performances that I've had, certainly, and that I love to watch, is when you can see that surrender element and you can feel the flow in the room. You know, and the other thing I wrote on in the same concept as this flow, I suppose, it was after I played a difficult Bach concert. The music was really hard. I felt nervous before it. And then I kind of had this thought, it helps when you're playing religious music, I suppose, like Bach and Handel, but it probably works with any profound music. I had this thought, I said, okay, as a musician, I'm not playing an instrument, I am the instrument. And it's this feeling of like, I'm just going to like surrender. Again, surrender comes into play. And just let whatever wants to flow through me, and not try to control it or put too much of a left brain kind of closing down on it, but just be open to what happens. Even if you think it might be wrong, you have to kind of let it flow out. So there was some of the musical reflections I had. Oh, I have another one here too. So I was talking to my friend maybe a week ago, and we were talking, I mentioned like, hey, like you were at two concerts I had this past year where it was really difficult, and I could have, and I felt nervous, but I could have felt way more nervous, and they both went really well. And he was in the trumpet section with me, and I was like, you know, you have an energy backstage that's really comfortable. It sort of like keeps the vibe fun and like not getting too heavy, all that stuff. And he goes, yeah, man, backstage matters. And so I just wrote that down like a week ago in the same musical reflections note in my phone. Just this idea that we always practice what we're going to do on stage and think, how are we going to act on stage? How are we going to look on stage? Especially if there's like a live stream or something, you know, oh, do I sound like this? Do I sound like that? But don't forget that backstage matters too. The vibe that you create with other musicians translates to the vibes you can create on stage, and whether people's nervous systems will be in that place to take risks and go for things, or if are people going to be stuck and feel judged and all of that. So backstage matters. I love that. Okay, so the next topic that I wrote here to talk about, something that's been on both my mind and my wife's mind. She's been reading a book by him, Carl Jung. If you haven't heard this name, I mean, chances are most people have, but Jung was the founder of analytical psychology. So think things like dream analysis, the unconscious, psychological archetypes, integrating your shadow. If you've heard of anything like this, that these things come from him and his influence. He lived from like the late 1800s to like 1960 something, I think. But it's really been on our minds a ton the past year. And Jung is one of those figures that when I hear other people talk about it on podcasts and things, it comes with this weird, like you discover him and then start to notice, you know, coincidences, and we'll talk some about that, but it's just a really cool topic area. And as you get older and reflect more on your own psychology and try to go deeper into your own mind, Jung is both terrifying and really interesting. So I'm totally not qualified to talk about it, but I'll do my best here. One of the things I love about Jung and why I feel like I'm enticed by his stuff is that I've always strived to have like a scientifically literate worldview, and I keep up with science and I care about understanding science and the details and all of that. But I also have this musician side of me that values the more spiritual and magical parts of being human, making art, you know, expressing the human condition and appreciating mystery and all of that kind of stuff. So I think I'm drawn to Jung because he has a way of blending science and rigorous psychological analysis with mythology and spirituality, really keeping an open mind to lots of things. So I think it's a great lens to view the world, especially if you're looking to have that sort of more magical, spiritual, I don't know, 10 years ago me would be cringing at the fact that I'm using these words, but here we go. So the first really cool Carl Jung topic that I wanted to talk about was synchronicity. And this is a term he coined in the 50s to mean like the kind of coincidence that seemed to defy probability, don't have an obvious like cause and effect relationship. So these are just coincidences that are too crazy to write off as meaningless, even though they might be. But so, you know, and it's not coincidences all external in the world. It's usually to signal some kind of external event perfectly aligning with an internal psychological event or psychological state, usually in a way that like stops you in your tracks where you're like, holy crap, that was a crazy coincidence. And probably everybody's had this to a degree. You know, I had one recently where I was driving home and I thought of a particular friend that I haven't called in a while, and I was like, I'm going to call them right now. And they called me in that very 10 seconds where they popped into my head. That kind of thing can just make you scratch your chin for sure. Or maybe, you know, especially as you start to read Jung, you'll be dreaming about some of the symbols and imagery that he talks about. And then you'll see something in real life that you're like, that can't just be a random way that shadow or those leaves or whatever it is arranged themselves. So this is what synchronicity means. I want to tell a couple of versions that my wife Yanka and I have had over the past year that made us feel like, oh crap, what's going on here? So the first one requires going back to what sort of got us back into Carl Jung and thinking about him and reading him, which is there's a Carl Jung library. I could walk there in 30 minutes. I could drive there in like 3 to 5 minutes. It's very close to where we live. And we saw it many times and always thought like, oh, we should definitely like go in there and check it out. Maybe like buy a book and read it, whatever. Let's just see what's going on in that library. And we never made it to the library. But we did make it to a free bookstore totally on the other side of town. It's this bookstore called The Book Cycle, and I think it's open one day a week. And you basically go in and take whatever you want. They have books that people donate, and you can just take as much as you want. You could take one book, you could take 10 books. They generally just require that you give your email and sign up for their email newsletter or whatever. It's probably some way to get a grant. But it's cool concept. So we went there randomly. This was like 6 months ago, 7 months ago. I don't know. Random Thursday morning. I think Thursdays is the day they're open. And we just shopped around in this hot warehouse looking for free books to take home. I was like, let's fill up one bag. And then we just got a new bookshelf. Let's fill it up with books. So anyways, one of the books I found, I just saw this book on the bookshelf, and it was some kind of almost like labyrinth-like symbol on the front. And I grabbed it, and it was a Carl Jung book about symbolic, I forget the exact title. It's on our coffee table now. And anyways, the book happened to be from that very Carl Jung library. Someone years ago hadn't returned it. So yeah, we brought home that book that day. But also, that's the same day we were at this free bookstore that my wife, Yanka, found the book I mentioned earlier, The Demon and the Angel. So she began reading that book, The Demon and the Angel, while at the same time flipping through this book on symbols. It's a lot easier to read this one than another Jung book I tried to read because it's more looking at pictures and analyzing them and talking about this and that. So it's a good one if you're not trying to get your head all clouded up with like academic language and like long run-on sentence translations and all that. Okay, so this all leads to she's reading this book for months. We go to Turkey. She's reading it there. We come back, you know, very slowly reading a couple of pages here and there. I think she was on page 200 and something. The book's like 500 pages. So she's on page, I'm just going to make up a number, let's say 200. And we decide on a Sunday or Saturday morning, let's go to this park. It's about 5 minute drive and it's a really beautiful park. And she sat there the first day that she learned that she won a job here in Houston. She sat in this park and really took it in and was very present moment. And the sun was nice and just, it's, you know, made a memory. So we were like, let's go back to this park and just sit down and read a book and be in the sun. It was a beautiful day. So we're at this, by the way, this park is called Menil Park. And she's reading page 200 and whatever of this book. And it starts talking about the very park we were sitting in. It was talking about Menil Park and how it's situated directly next to the Rothko Chapel, filled with Rothko's paintings. And it talked for pages and pages. And she was like, holy crap, Luke, like, I just randomly got to a page that started talking about the park we're in and the chapel right over there with Rothko's paintings. And so we were like, that's pretty crazy. And we definitely have to go into the chapel now. So we hung out for a little longer and then tuck ourselves into the chapel, which is open most days and free. It's really dark inside. It has a very intense lighting. I think there's no artificial light inside. It's just designed to have like the sunlight come through in certain angles. Think of it like a very non-denominational chapel. And his paintings are super dark paintings, like especially in that intense lighting of the chapel. It's all like dark blacks and purples and dark plum colors, really abstract stuff. And I think the idea is like you're supposed to be staring into the infinite void, staring into the abyss. That actually makes me think of what's the Nietzsche quote? Be careful about staring into the abyss because it stares back into you, something like that. So that felt like a pretty good example of a synchronicity of just like getting into Carl Jung from this bookstore, then getting another book from that store, randomly reading it, and then arriving in this park at the same time that she got to this random page. It was like two pages that it talked about Rothko and these paintings and then moved on to a different topic. And then there was another pretty trippy synchronicity from one of my dreams. And obviously in Jungian analysis, like dreams are a big part of it. So I had this dream and I don't often remember my dreams vividly. I sometimes do. And this happened to be one where I woke up and was like, oh crap, that was like a very clear, vivid dream. And the dream was I was in the sort of backwoods of the childhood house I grew up in. I had a lot of woods behind the house where I grew up in. and it was snowing out. So it was like, I was almost like crawling through the snow or something. It was like blizzard-like conditions. And I saw a bright red cardinal on a branch, and the red was really popping against the snowy white background. And then this cardinal just started, like, whatever cardinals do, like, making its call to me, and, like, I kind of was crawling towards it, and that's around when I woke up. So, I was talking about, what is it, that dream to Yanka the next day, my wife, because, you know, we have been into Jung, and I was like, oh, isn't that kind of like a specifically vivid dream? So I remember asking AI, like, oh, is there any kind of Jungian analysis of this specific dream? And I told it what happened. And so, yeah, I mean, there are things with birds, you know, birds are the human soul or spirit ascending or finding higher consciousness. So there's all kinds of things with birds. But specifically, red is a huge color for Jungian analysis and for another topic he was really into of alchemy. So red or rubedo is, you know, Latin for redness. It was that alchemy term for the final stage of achieving the philosopher's stone. In alchemy, the philosopher's stone is the substance that could, you know, turn anything into gold, I guess. In Jungian psychology, it would be the process of individuation, right? The integration of opposites in the psyche. And so from this point of view, the cardinal would be like my subconscious calling out for the waking conscious to integrate or to individuate, to go to a higher level or something like that. But anyways, that's not the coincidence part. That was just like, you know, the dream, and whether you want to analyze it or not, like, that's up to each person. But the coincidence part was the next morning, I was on the balcony having some coffee, and there was a bird in a tree. I can't see this bird because it's like the trees are below our balconies on the fifth floor. And I started doing a whistle along to the bird, something like that kind of sound. And then the bird was like calling back, and it was like, after a couple times back and forth, it was very obvious. I would pause and then no sound, and then I would like whistle to this thing and it would like respond immediately. So then Yanka was like, what kind of bird is it? I was like, I don't know, I can't see it. And I pulled out this app on my phone, Merlin is the name of it, and it listens to your environment. It tells you what birds are around. So I pulled out this app to see what bird it was, and sure enough, it was a cardinal. I'm looking at this bright red cardinal on my screen. I had been having this 5-minute chat with a cardinal, and we both like got goosebumps. We're like, oh man, that's such a crazy coincidence. So this is the kind of thing that the synchronicity from Jungian psychology would have you notice in the world. And so, like, okay, now that I said that, let's snap a little bit out of the wooey gooey, you know, way of being, and let me, I can bring my more prickly skeptical brain back onto the scene and say, like, yeah, it's fair to ask, is thinking like this just our feeble minds desperately trying to find patterns and create order on top of a chaotic universe? Definitely that could be it, right? I had a dream about a cardinal. Okay. Probably every morning there was a cardinal there I could have been whistling with. It just happened to like do it that day. It was a coincidence, and then I happened to make more meaning out of it. All of that's possible. But could our brains be picking up subtle signals of a non-physical order behind the universe? And then it makes me think, like, whether I say I believe that coincidence or not, is belief about like propositional truths like that? Or is it more about living your life out, like being a certain way, like kind of living as if something are true without propositionally thinking it's true? Those are deep questions that maybe if we do a full episode or a series of Jung episodes, we could dive into questions like that. To me, my conclusion in 2025 would be that the synchronicity stuff is like a reminder from the universe. And by universe, I could also just mean a reminder from our deeper psyche. but it's a reminder to pay attention, not so much like to make a definite meaning out of the coincidence and say, oh my God, the universe is talking to me or something like that, although you could. But it's just to pay attention, to humbly pay attention, because you might be on the verge of a meaningful growth of consciousness or a discovery of some kind. And it's just kind of maybe your brain's way of telling you, like, be sharper, pay attention, notice what's around you. So that's the one Jungian concept. The other one is called the coincidence of opposites. It can also be called the unity of opposites. And I think most people have heard a concept like this, or basically this concept, but in other places like Eastern philosophies like Zen or Hinduism or Buddhism, you know, it's this idea that everything is interdependent and you define everything in relation to the other thing. You know, think like the yin-yang symbol, right? You can't define white without the contrast of black or, you know, anything. You could go back to, what is it, Heraclitus, the only thing constant is change, right? This kind of paradox, or what is it, Aristotle's unmoved mover, right? Something is both the source and the purpose of all motion. And so the point of the coincidence of opposites is that at the deeper levels of stuff, opposites paradoxically coincide. And so you could probably think about that in a scientific physics kind of way, but in Jungian psychology, it's the idea that the psyche operates through a tension of opposites like this. Think, you know, conscious, unconscious, masculine, feminine, good, evil, dark, light. And then you can even think physically about our brain's hemispheric structure, right? Our brain is pretty evenly split, physically, I mean. And there's a small bundle of nerve fibers called the corpus callosum connecting the two hemispheres. But it's because our hemispheres really do process and understand the world in different ways. There's a great book, I talk about it way too much on previous episodes, but I guess I can link it yet again, by Ian McGilchrist, and it's called The Divided Mind. I hope I got that title right. But he talks so eloquently about and of course is rigorous scientifically, about these different hemispheric ways of approaching the world, the right hemisphere being like much more opening up to the world and seeing the big picture, and the left hemisphere understanding the world through, you know, chopping things into pieces, seeing things in categories, there being firm boundaries between things, more of a prickly way of being, whereas the right hemisphere is more of that wiggly or gooey way of being. And think of the left hemisphere as being like the forest, or sorry, the trees, and the right hemisphere is being the forest. Or, you know, the left hemisphere is like seeing all the notes, and the right hemisphere is seeing the melody, seeing the whole symphony. It's seeing the big picture. So this coincidence of opposites idea. Let's start with an easy example, like God. and what I wrote here in my note on thinking about Jungian stuff was how depth and height coincide. So you can see many places in many traditions where God is represented as the highest value, or the unity of all values at the pinnacle, the ultimate ideal, like some kind of North Star to strive for. But at the same time, and in the same traditions, you'll often hear God talked about as a foundation, the bedrock of the hierarchy. The logos that enables the universe to make any sense at all. And so this depth and height coinciding, you know, you could imagine, even if you're still trying to be very scientific about this, and you're taking an evolutionary perspective on how our psychology evolved, what would the label be for our deepest evolutionary instinct or deepest value? Religion might be one of the ways that our species outcompeted the other homo-type species that we competed with. You know, think Homo habilis or Homo Neanderthal or Homo erectus. That's the only three I can think of. But it's this idea that we were able to form big groups of humans unified around certain ideals. And what an advantage that is compared to the typical, the other, including us earlier and probably the other Homo, like take Neanderthals or something. Imagine you can form groups of 100 or 150 people. I think there's something called Dunbar's number, which is like psychologically the number of people on average people can remember faces and stories and kind of have a character for in their head. Like a detailed character. It's like kind of what the tribe sizes were. But with religion and with unifying around these sort of deep values and deep narratives about the world and having a culture, humans could form groups of 10,000 and easily outcompete other groups. So if you take that evolutionary perspective and imagine that maybe we could have evolved a deepest instinct, in this view, you would say, coincidentally, our deepest instinct is also our highest good. I mean, you could say, like, maybe we use this word God, which, as far as I remember, was not pronounceable in the Old Testament. I think it's something called a tetragrammaton, where it was like, think Yahweh, but without the vowel. So it was just like YHWH. And so you can't say that. So the idea was, you know, you can't put a firm definition on something you can't say, maybe. But perhaps this word God that we use is a unity of opposites, where something can be an ultimate goal above and at the same time an irreducible foundation below. I mean, this is kind of the idea that paradox is something that in the religious perspective, you aren't supposed to try to resolve paradoxes by like solving them, but by accepting them or surrendering to them. Think Moses coming across the burning bush, right? A bush that's eternally burning is a paradox, and he does not try to figure it out. He takes his shoes off and kneels or something, right? He's on holy ground, that kind of idea. But let me be less religious in language to talk about it in a way that connects with my experience in music, certainly, which would be transcendence comes from the depths. So like, you know, or there's a young quote I wrote here. No tree can grow to heaven unless its roots reach down to hell. I think for Jung, he's like talking a lot about integrating the shadow and going deep into the psychology to see like some of the evil stuff that's part of you down there. But I just, in music, I feel like the deeper you go into the details of the music and the depth, that sort of discipline part from the quote I said earlier in the podcast, then the more likely you are to find transcendence within it, something like that. You know, I don't know. I wrestle with this stuff because it's not just religious thinkers or the gooey spiritual types, you know, being lazy and with their thinking or not prickly enough, not being intellectual enough. This is also philosophically at the depths, like of what it means to be human and try to understand the world and understand epistemology and what it means to know things. You know, like we have a culture beneath all the values that we just assume, right? There are axioms of these your axiomatic values underneath our culture that are what makes it work. We don't even know all of these. I think it's hard to state them, and probably that's why we use myth and story to gesture at them, because they're very hard to articulate specifically, and they're also not as effective at, you know, communicating them is not very effective when you just list them as a set of rules as compared to like learning them through a story. So. Yeah, I don't know. I think there are certain axioms beneath our culture, and we need culture to survive and keep going. So there's a transcendent aiming, a sort of north star above that serves as our compass. But there are also these values that feel like they're beneath us and grounding the very way we understand the world. So that's one version of a coincidence of opposites. And I haven't read this, but I found Nicholas of Cusa. You know, he wrote this 1400s, whatever year, I forget, on learned ignorance. And he more or less defines God as the unity of all contradictions, whatever that means to you. I just wrote that down quickly here. But to close this coincidence of opposites idea, I wanted to end with a quote I found years ago, but it's been on my mind with this topic recently. It's a quote by the famous physicist Niels Bohr, and he wrote, "There are trivial truths and there are also great truths. The opposite of a trivial truth is plainly false. The opposite of a great truth is also true." So I don't know, it gives me more confidence to go down this path of belief when even a physicist is kind of figuring out this paradoxical foundation to reality, perhaps. So yeah, what's a good conclusion for thinking about Jung, and whether it's worth it, or whether it's worth making an episode out of it for me, or whether it's worth any of you who happen to listen to this, you know, exploring it yourself. I think my 2025, like my current state of mind, my conclusion to this tension, this paradox, I guess, of contemplating life and how to do it, it's another Jung quote, which he says, "The greatest and most important problems of life are all fundamentally insoluble. They can never be solved, but only outgrown." So again, this concept of surrender or humility comes in, like at some point you have to turn off that intellect and just kind of surrender to a problem. I'm not saying surrender to like, you know, figuring out how to do your taxes or something like that. But, you know, if you're trying to figure out like why there seems to be a paradox at the bottom of reality, maybe the point is to surrender to that. And how do you surrender to that? Like an update to this note, I wrote that down a couple months ago, and I wrote this down as I was copying and pasting it into the current note I'm reading here. The update I wrote was, perhaps they can be individually quote unquote solved, in the sense that you can live your attempted solution. You can walk your specifically individual path, not at finding an ultimate solution, but walking the path towards a solution, right? The attempt at the solution, which is also a very Kodawari concept, right? The idea that life is not about destinations and the final goal of achieving something, but more about the process and just genuinely walking the path, so to speak. So that's another Jungian concept. It's called individuation, which is, you know, integrating the opposites into a unified whole in your unique way. It's also analogous to I mentioned the Philosopher's Stone earlier. You know, that's like a metaphor from alchemy for perhaps like the in Jungian terms, the capital S self, the integration of your psychology where opposites are unified. So I wanted to close this Jung section with a quote from his Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. I just thought it's a great, if you were to give like maybe one quote of Jung to really sit with and think about, it might be this one. Quote, "The meaning of my existence is that life has addressed a question to me, or conversely, I myself am a question which is addressed to the world, and I must communicate my answer, for otherwise I am dependent upon the world's answer." I'll leave it at that. So the last little section I had here, and I'll give you my favorite quotes that I wrote down this year too. It was just like, yeah, maybe a lot of people listening are having the skeptical voice in their head is going like, okay, like enough with all that, you know, spiritual wooey gooey, like wiggly type of thinking. And I get that. I have that voice in my head too. But it made me want to jot down a couple notes I took. I tried to maybe think about writing an article called something like Being Skeptical of Skepticism or something clever like that. I wrote down a lot of notes, but I never got to writing it into an article. But I guess I've just been reflecting on the problem of skepticism, and you know how that's changed for me over the years is quite drastic. So younger me used to be really into the skeptics movements. I listened to like podcasts with I don't even know their names anymore, but like I would watch shows or YouTube channels, you know, and they were all, you know, getting off on debunking anything spiritual or religious, right? It's like the kind of people wearing a materialist, atheist, or maybe agnostic, whatever it is, they're wearing these kinds of like, I am a follower of science and only science kind of badge proudly on their sleeves. And I used to, like, I was into that, and like, I would be the guy at parties if somebody's telling me the very story I told you about coincidences earlier, I'd be the one telling them all the reasons why that's just a coincidence. There's nothing interesting there, and there's no reason to think any meaning to it, blah, blah, blah. But the older I get, this just feels too boring. It's like, I don't know, it's like, do you just want to be like a copy editor of science, you know, or like some kind of mouthpiece for science, but like not, just it's taking too much pleasure in being prickly and getting rid of wiggly things that do deserve to be there, right? Certain wiggly, more magical, spiritual ways of thinking bring a lot of meaning or drive creativity. So anyway, I'm not saying skepticism is bad, period, but I think reflexive skepticism, like if you just do it without thinking, just as a reflex, I don't think that's the kind of skepticism that should define your personality, or certainly it used to define my personality, and I feel like it doesn't anymore. And what did I write here? Oh, like, would you want on your tombstone, he never believed in anything without proper evidence, so he was never fooled by anything. Like, I don't think that's a great, you know, memory to have. It doesn't, to me, at least from my view now, it doesn't feel like a compliment, right? You know, to never have taken a leap of faith to believe in something, right? Or imagine he never fell in love, you know, because it was too risky and you could never trust someone completely or whatever. You know, it's this same concept, like falling in love or surrender, right? It's, yeah, sometimes I think you're supposed to believe in things, right? It's like, I don't know, as a musician, like when you play a phrase, you have to believe in the phrase you're playing. I can say at least that. So with the young stuff floating around, I guess my 2025 reflection here is that I'm definitely I'm careful about being overly skeptical and prickly. Because it does, while it can cut away some of the bullshit, it can also rob your life of some of the magic that makes it more meaningful. I mean, being completely naive and believing everything is obviously bad, yes. But so is being cynical and not believing almost anything, or even if you just turn your skepticism dial super high and like you're almost never believing anything. I think it's not a bad thing to turn that skepticism dial off here and there. Maybe the key is like most things, it's like balance. You have to balance skepticism with the instinct to believe and the instinct to play. I mean, the older I get, the less and less I enjoy, or let's be honest, can even tolerate hanging out with people who like, don't have this instinct for play or don't have this openness. I like to call it wiggliness. It's like the opposite of prickliness, right? It's like an openness. It's like a humility. It's like a sense of like, let's take an adventure together rather than like, let's just go through the motions or something like that. I see this a lot in the music world where people are so obsessed with technical perfection and playing things exactly with some kind of predetermined plan. And like it's music becomes about closing down on the music and getting it right. But that is preventing you from being open to possibilities and open to genuine play in the moment. I mean, play is all about the moment. So I feel like that same dialing down that skepticism in other areas of my life made me more open to finding that genuine play even when performing. So I get that there seems to be a sort of religious thread running through this episode. Maybe that's just part of getting older. It's not necessarily, you know, just believing everything literally, but wrestling with the depth of it, something like that. So the couple of quotes that I wrote down are on this topic. It, you know, it helps to have Carl Jung type stuff in your mind. But the first one was a Francis Bacon quote. And again, these are scientists, so that's interesting in its own way. He wrote, "A little philosophy inclineth man's mind to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion." Another poetic way of writing this was by Werner Heisenberg. Think Breaking Bad, right? Heisenberg uncertainty principle, if you remember high school physics or whatever. He wrote, "The first gulp from the glass of natural sciences will turn you into an atheist, but at the bottom of the glass, God is waiting for you." And so those two quotes kind of sync up with the Jungian stuff that I was talking about. And also just the, like, having the space in your mind, having the sandbox in your mind where you can play with ideas more gracefully and leave your skepticism in a different room of your mind and play with other ideas, something like that. And then the last quote I wrote here, which I think nicely applies to just so much of what's happening in the world right now. I never talk about politics on this podcast, but I think this quote, take it however you hear it, but I don't know what this person does. I just found it probably randomly on Nasnin, but the quote was, "We don't see things as they are. We see them as we are." And for me, the lesson there is just like, people are doing, this is another Jungian term, but people are doing a lot of projection right now where they think they're seeing the world, but so much of that is projecting parts of themselves that they don't want to see or can't see. In Jungian terms, you project these parts of yourself that you can't tolerate seeing onto the world so as to understand them. So I don't know, that quote's been floating around my mind for sure. I think that's about it. You know, all these reflections, I think I'm questioning deeper things like this because, you know, you see culture wars happening and you're living in the West. There seems to be a struggle to find what our identity is right now and to find like what the deeper meaning is. I've also been reading a book called The Meaning Crisis, and things just feel kind of chaotic culturally. And I think when that happens, instead of getting caught up in all of that mostly bullshit, especially with social media, it seems like a good idea to go deeper and be more sure of what your principles are, what your life philosophy is, know what you should be proud and inflexible about, and know what you should be humble and more open about, things like that. And, oh, look, I wrote one more quote here to end the episode. So I've been rewatching Mad Men because it's been recently, they put it on HBO. So I'm somewhere in season 2 or 3, but I've seen the show like 6 or 7 times. It's my favorite show. It's the best show ever made. So deep. It's like listening to a symphony. You can do it, you know, endless times. This is what Mad Men is like for us. So there's a scene, it's a very short quote. One of the office workers, Joan, offers to make Don Draper, who's the main character. Joan offers to make him a drink and says, like, "What would you like?" And he says, quote, "Make it simple, but significant." So with that said, thanks for listening. I hope this wasn't too crazy of a rant. I'll just publish it anyway, because like, who cares? I need to get at least one episode out this year. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a happy holidays and a happy new year.
All right, thanks for listening to this episode of Exploring Kodawari. If you enjoyed it, we hope you'll consider sharing it on social media and with friends. You can also help us out by leaving a rating and a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Those help us more than you would think. And if you'd like to help us out in a more substantial way, consider going over to our website to make a donation through PayPal. Links are in the episode notes for this. You can do this as a one-time donation or a recurring monthly donation. All of that support will help us to set aside time in order to create content for the podcast and the blog. And finally, please get in touch with us and say hi, either on social media or privately through email. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.